Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. The organization is over 100 years old, bringing speakers on issues of all across the board, politics, science, literature, current events, to discuss whatever is interesting to humanity. Has been going on for more than 100 years here. As you can see from the walls out there, many, many, many famous people have spoken here over the last 100 years, I think starting with Theodore Roosevelt. So tonight, we don't have Theodore Roosevelt, but we do have Bethany Cobb, an NSF fellow in astronomy. She did undergraduate work at Williams and her graduate work at Yale, and teaches at the Osher Lifelong Institute at Berkeley. Now, please welcome Bethany.
So I'll obviously be speaking today about Edwin Hubble. Now, if you hear the name Hubble, what you probably think of is this, rather than Edwin Hubble. This, of course, is the Hubble Space Telescope, which you've all seen the beautiful images that this telescope has produced over the last few years. And, of course, this has been just one of the most important instruments in astronomy over the last decade or two decades now. And what I want to tell you about today is that Hubble was not named randomly for Edwin Hubble just because he was an eminent astronomer. I'll get to the specific reason for this being named the Hubble Space Telescope later in this talk. I want to start back a little ways first, though. Of course, the first great real modern astronomer that we know of is, of course, Galileo. And I'd like to draw a parallel between Galileo and Hubble, because even though they're separated by about 300 years in time, they were both observational astronomers who used really the best available instruments of their day in order to really fundamentally change and reshape mankind's perception of the universe. Now, Galileo, of course, provided the observational evidence that the Earth orbits the sun and not vice versa. Here's just a few of the pieces of evidence he had with looking at, for example, the moons going around Jupiter. Now, this was, of course, that happened in the 1600s. That was one of the first real major developments in modern astronomy, of course, the Copernican Revolution and Galileo's verification of it. Then move on to Kepler, his laws of motion. He really, he kind of refined the Copernican model by realizing that instead of orbits being perfect circles, they are in fact ellipses. Newton brought some physical laws onto the scene, particularly his law of gravitation, the realization that every body in the universe is gravitationally attracted to every other body in the universe, and that the gravitation depends on the mass of the objects and the distance between them. Important changes in technology include spectroscopy. This is actually a spectrum of the sun. And what we've done is we've passed light from the sun through a prism. And what you can see is all the different wavelengths of light that make up sunlight. And you'll notice that a few of the very specific wavelengths are missing. And what this actually tells us about is the chemical makeup of the sun. Now, of course, this is a beautiful spectrum because we can get lots of light from the sun, but we can do this with many other objects in the universe to learn about their chemical and physical properties. Photography was another major paradigm shift in astronomy. I'm always marvel over early astronomers who had to do everything by their naked eye and just by pencil and paper, writing it down, making very careful measurements. But, of course, photography allows you to take a very precise record of the sky. And, of course, you can see deeper in photographs than you can with just a telescope and your naked eye. And then, of course, larger and larger telescopes were coming on the scene. And, of course, you want a large telescope in order to collect more light. A telescope's diameter is related to its light-collecting power. The larger that is, the more light you can collect. So that's kind of the state of astronomy from the 1600s to the 1900s. We were learning many, many things. Many new technologies were really increasing our knowledge. But there were still a lot of open questions, even in the beginning of the 1900s. Some of those questions were things like, why does the sun shine? What powers stars? Are we a unique system of a star with planets orbiting, or are there planets orbiting other stars? We still were very fuzzy about the details of the Milky Way. How big is it? What is its shape and size? Where does the Earth reside within the Milky Way? These were all open questions. One of the other open questions is, what is the extent, the size, and the shape of the universe as a whole? And one of the main questions within this question was, what are the spiral nebulae? So when you look through a telescope at the night sky, you can see many of these beautiful spiral nebulae. In the early 1900s, it was unclear. Are these clouds of gas? Are these groups of stars? Are they located within our own Milky Way? Are they somewhere else in the universe, off at a great distance, almost like little island universes? These were open questions. And there was, in 1920, actually a great debate about the property of these spiral nebulae. Now, this was a debate between astronomers Shapley and Curtis. It occurred at the meeting of the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. in 1920. The debate was between Shapley and Curtis. Now, Shapley was an astronomer at the Mount Wilson Observatory. He was a young, ambitious astronomer, sort of up and coming, but had published several important discoveries. Curtis was another Californian astronomer at the Lick Observatory. He was an established astronomer, very well-respected, conservative, a little bit skeptical. These two astronomers had very different views about the nature of the spiral nebulae, and in fact, all astronomers at that time had different views about what the nature of these things were. Now, this wasn't a true debate that actually occurred. They gave lectures, 40-minute lectures, one after another. Shapley believed that the spiral nebulae are actually some sort of gas cloud inside the Milky Way. So if you can imagine, this is a picture of our Milky Way looking out, looking down from the outside. And there's all these little spiral nebulae, but they're hanging out within the Milky Way itself. Now, Curtis thought something different, but Shapley, of course, had, you know, evidence, to quote scientific evidence, and he said, well, for example, the Andromeda spiral nebulae, if that were actually outside our own Milky Way galaxy, then it would have to be absurdly large. He also noted that there are nova that could be seen in these spiral nebulae. And if these spiral nebulae were off at great distance, then these nova, these new stars, these brightening stars, they'd have to be absurdly bright for them to be that bright up in the spiral nebulae that we see. And he also cited evidence published by another astronomer who thought that he had measured actual rotation in one of these spiral nebulae. Now, we now know, of course, those measurements were in error, but Shapley was actually friends with this astronomer and so had no reason to doubt him. And in order for this rotation to be realistic, it would have to, again, be from something that is in our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, Curtis disagreed, of course. He suggested that these spiral nebulae were not in our own galaxy, but were somewhere else. So let's send these spiral nebulae outside of the Milky Way. So now, instead of a Milky Way populated with these spiral nebulae, we have the Milky Way as just one of many spiral nebulae in a much larger universe. Curtis's reasonings for this included the fact that you can see these beautiful dust lanes in some galaxies. And this is similar to the dust lane that actually runs through the center of the Milky Way. He also noted that the galaxies were observed in their spectra to have very high Doppler shifts. Now, this is a shift in the wavelength of light that can happen due to motion, due to velocity. And these galaxies, these spiral nebulae, appeared to have extreme Doppler shifts. And for them to have such great velocity suggests that they can't reside within our own galaxy because they would have exited quite rapidly. Now, this debate went on for 40 minutes and 40 minutes. It didn't really have a conclusion at the end of the debate. I mean, there was just not enough evidence to really be able to pinpoint one answer as the right answer. We needed something else. We needed Edwin Hubble to come along and get us some observations. Now, Edwin Hubble was born in 1889 in Marshfield, Missouri. From a young age, he was a very natural scholar and athlete. He studied mathematics, astronomy, philosophy at the University of Chicago, and actually became one of the very first Oxford Rhodes Scholars. In Oxford, he studied law and Spanish, and picked up quite a few British mannerisms and affectations, which he brought back to America with him, and occasionally irritated his fellow American astronomers with these affectations. He came back to America and actually taught high school for a time. He taught Spanish and physics and math and did some coaching. In 1917, he earned his PhD in astronomy at the Yerkes Observatory at the University of Chicago. And his dissertation was the photographic investigations of faint nebulae. So from a very early time in his interest in astronomy, he was interested in these spiral nebulae, what they were, what we can learn from them. Now, he was actually offered a job at Mount Wilson by George Hale, one of the founders of that observatory, but he chose to delay the job to actually serve in the Army in World War I. But he eventually did become an astronomer at the Mount Wilson Observatory in 1919. Now, what was really interesting that was going on Mount Wilson was the creation and the building of the 100-inch Hooker telescope. That's 2.5 meters in diameter. There's a mirror sitting at the base of this telescope that is 100 inches in diameter. And this was the largest telescope in the world when it was built, by quite a lot, too. So his arrival at Mount Wilson coincided pretty much with the beginnings of observations through this telescope. This was, again, at Mount Wilson, near Pasadena. You may have heard of this observatory recently because of the wildfires that threatened it and actually came quite close to destroying what is both a historic site for astronomy and a continuing functional astronomical observatory till this day. This telescope is still in use doing science. The first light of this telescope was in 1917. Amusingly, although not amusingly at the time, when they first pointed the telescope up to the sky, they pointed at Jupiter and expected a beautiful, crisp image and got a completely distorted mess. Multiple images of Jupiter all overlapping. You can imagine they just built the biggest telescope in the world and it doesn't appear to work correctly. There was some concern that the mirror had bubbles in it or something that was causing distortion. Now, fortunately, what had actually happened was there had been some workers in the dome, and they had left the dome slit open all day, and the sun had beat down on this very sensitive piece of equipment, and that heating had actually warped the mirror of the telescope enough to be very noticeable when you looked through the telescope. They spent a very, very nervous night waiting for the telescope to cool off. And fortunately, it did. And once the mirror cooled down appropriately, the distortions disappeared, and they had a wonderful instrument to work with. Now, this actually reigned for 3 decades as the largest telescope. It was surpassed in 1948 by the 200-inch observatory, telescope in Palomar Observatory. And Edwin Hubble, at that time, of course, a very eminent astronomer, was given the honor of being the first astronomer to look at the heavens through this telescope. Now, with this instrument and Edwin Hubble's recent arrival at Mount Wilson, he was really set up in a good position to start doing a lot of interesting science. And one of the things that we needed in order to settle the debate about these spiral nebulae is to measure the distance to them, because that would answer the question, how far away they are. Now, you may ask, well, why didn't we do this earlier? Turns out it's not very easy. We see a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional universe on the sky. Figuring out that third dimension is really very non-trivial. Now, we have a few techniques. The first technique is parallax, and this is actually the only measurement that is really a direct geometrical measurement of a distance to an object. And unfortunately, it doesn't work when you get too far away. So this only works for the most nearby objects. But basically what happens is you go out with your telescope in January and you point at some part of the sky. And what you'll see is a foreground star and a whole bunch of background stars. Although when you take the first picture, of course, you don't know which is which. But then you wait 6 months until the Earth has orbited halfway around the Sun. Now you take a picture of that same part of the sky, and what you'll see is that the foreground star appears to have shifted with respect to the background stars. And since you know the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and you can measure the angle of shift, this is called what we call the parallactic angle, you can actually do quite simple geometry to determine the distance to that object. Now, would it be that easy from the picture I've shown you up on the slide here? Of course, it's never such a giant shift. If it were such a big shift, we would have known that the Earth revolves around the Sun many years before we needed Galileo's telescope. But of course, what you're actually going to see is something much subtler in the night sky. Maybe something like this. And even that is a big shift. If you can see it with your naked eye, it's a pretty significant shift. So this is not easy. And it really only works for the very nearest stars. Not even a small fraction of our galaxy is covered with this technique. We need something else to start measuring greater distances. We can use, for that, standard candles. Now, this is an indirect measure, but it does work. Think of it this way. If you have an object, for example, a candle, and you know the intrinsic brightness of that object, then you move the object to some greater distance. It appears that the object is dimmer. But the object isn't actually physically dimmer, it only appears dimmer because it's at a greater distance. And so if you know the intrinsic luminosity and you measure the observed brightness, then you can actually calculate the distance to that object. This is actually quite a simple geometric formula where the brightness of an object drops as the distance squared. And this is because light spreads out in a sphere around any light-emitting object. Now, this is great, but you need to know the intrinsic luminosity of the object to begin with. So how do we do that? Well, one of the standard candles that we can use are called Cepheid variable stars. This is actually a picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. You may not be able to see it, but I promise you it's there. I'll move my little mouse here. There's this little star right here. And this is sort of a time-lapsed image. It's the same region of this galaxy. And this star changes brightness ever so slightly. It's hard to tell with the naked eye, but it's something that we can measure by taking photographs and images, and we can measure the change in brightness. And it turns out that you can measure what's called the light curve, the change in brightness over time of these objects. And when you do that, what you see is that it has this very distinct shape, this sort of curve to it. This is a distinct shape that we can see. And we can measure the period of time it takes for the object to go from brightest phase, down to dimmest phase, back up to brightest phase. That's called one period. And that's something easy to measure. You go out night by night by night, and you take an image, you take an image, you take an image, you measure, and you graph. And it turns out that the period that you measure is actually directly correlated with the intrinsic luminosity of a Cepheid variable. And it turns out that a variable with a short period is dimmer than a similar object that has a longer period. This was actually discovered by an astronomer named Harriet Leavitt, and she was not an astronomer as we think of astronomers today. She was what you would have called a computer. And she was one of many female computers whose job it was to look at photograph after photograph after photograph, spectrum after spectrum after spectrum, to record all the subtle, minute changes. And they became experts at this work day after day. And this is where some of the most major discoveries in astronomy came from, is this very careful, meticulous work that these computers were able to do. Now, Henrietta Leavitt was mostly interested in what we call the Small Magellanic Cloud. We now know this is a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way, and you can actually see the large and small Magellanic Clouds from the southern hemisphere if you go out on a dark night. Now, there are many images taken of the Small Magellanic Cloud, and it was her job to go through them and find all the variable stars. And what she noticed was this Cepheid period luminosity relationship. And she actually published this finding in 1908. It didn't really get much notice when she did the original publication of these Cepheids, but she did another paper a few years later. And that second paper actually became a very important piece of work that was noticed by a lot of astronomers because, hey, here's a way to measure the distance to various things in the universe, such as globular clusters in our own galaxies. That was one of the first things that was measured using Cepheids. Now, this work, of course, was being done, and we now have these wonderful standard candles. So along comes Hubble. He's got a huge telescope that can take very deep, detailed images of these spiral nebulae. And so one night in 1923, October 4th, Hubble had some time on the telescope. So they went out and they started taking some images of Andromeda, the Andromeda spiral nebulae. And it wasn't a very good night. The seeing was bad. This means the images are a little bit more blurred by the atmosphere than they are on good seeing nights. And so they weren't very impressed, but he noticed in one of his plates that there appeared to be a new star in Andromeda, a nova in the Andromeda galaxy. So the next night, he went out again. Fortunately, they had much better seeing. He did another picture of Andromeda to try to back up this initial discovery of the nova in Andromeda. He takes the image, he starts examining it. What he notices is he had not captured one nova in Andromeda, he'd captured three. Just by luck, there had been three nova in Andromeda when he took a picture. He took the images back down to his office, and he compared these plates, these images of Andromeda, with ones that had been taken in the years previous. And what he noticed was that one of these nova was not a nova, it was a variable star. So he could map the light curve of this variable star. And so he did that. He made the light curve. And what he noticed immediately was that it looked like a Cepheid variable. So now we have a Cepheid variable measured in the Andromeda spiral nebula. So now all he has to do is take the Cepheid period luminosity relation, plug in the observed period, the observed brightness, and get out on the other end, how distant this object is. You do this calculation, he gets out an answer of a million light years. A million light years. This was bigger than the entire universe that Shapley had suggested existed. This one spiral nebulae just destroyed Shapley's universe. And in fact, Shapley received a letter about Hubble's measurements, and he told his PhD student, here is the letter that has destroyed my universe. Now, of course, you go and do this again and again and again. You're never satisfied with one object. So you identify these Cepheid variables in many, many of the spiral nebulae. You carefully measure their brightness, their period. You use that period luminosity relationship. And the answer you get time and time again is that these spiral nebulae are simply far too distant to be part of the Milky Way. Now, of course, we know today that Andromeda is a little bit further away than that. It's about 2.5 million light years. But the exact value isn't important. What's really important is just that scale. So what Hubble has shown in these observations is that spiral nebulae are galaxies in their own right outside of our own galaxy. And this is just, you know, it makes the universe have a mind-boggling proportion. It's amazing. And it really did fundamentally change our view of the universe. This brings me back to the Hubble Space Telescope. Turns out that the main purpose of the Hubble Space Telescope is not the beautiful images that we're all familiar with. The main purpose of the Hubble Space Telescope was to observe Cepheid variables in distant galaxies to measure the distance to those galaxies. The Hubble Space Telescope, one of its primary missions, really was to increase our understanding about the size and the shape of the universe by measuring distances. And it did that in addition, of course, to the beautiful pictures that we've also gotten from it. Now, if Hubble had done nothing else as an astronomer, he would still be considered quite a revered and eminent astronomer. But, of course, he didn't stop there. He didn't just leave it at that. He knew that other astronomers had been taking Doppler shift measurements of these spiral nebulae. And again, with the Doppler shift, you can figure out velocity. And it works kind of like this. If you have a light-emitting object, and it's moving, for example, away from you, then the wavelengths of light, they sort of spread out as the object moves away from you. And longer wavelengths of light are actually a redder color of light, so we refer to this as a redshift. Now, on the other hand, if an object is heading towards you, the wavelengths of light pile up and get closer together, and that's a higher frequency of light, a bluer frequency of light, and that is what we call then a blue shift. And so you measure this by looking at the absorption lines or emission lines in the spectra of various objects. And you know from tests in a laboratory exactly the wavelength that these lines should be at because they're caused by known particles, known elements. And so you measure where they appear to have shifted in the spectra, and the change is actually what gives you the velocity, either a positive velocity when the object's moving away from you or a negative velocity when the object is moving towards you. That's simply how we define it. All right. So, oh, yes, I should also mention that Hubble was not alone in doing these observations, particularly the Doppler shift observations. He worked very closely with a staff astronomer at the Mount Wilson Observatory, named Milton Humason, who was not a PhD astronomer. He, in fact, had been the janitor. He had an eighth grade education, but he was working at the observatory, and it turned out that he had great skill and precision at working with these observations. So he was actually made a staff astronomer and worked very closely with Hubble to procure these observations. So now you have the distance that Hubble measured using the Cepheids and the velocity he measures using the redshift and the blueshift of the spectra. And so we're scientists. We like to make charts and graphs. So let's graph these two things, the galaxy velocity versus the galaxy distance. And this is the chart that Hubble made. Each of the points on this graph is a unique galaxy, unique spiral nebulae. And what you can see is that many, in fact, most of the galaxies are redshifted. Moreover, galaxies that are further away are higher redshifted than galaxies that are close. Now, yes, there are a couple blue-shifted galaxies on this plot, if you look closely. And that's all right. These are actually galaxies that are very close to us, such as the Andromeda Galaxy. Turns out, we're gravitationally attracted to one another. We're pulling each other in. And we will, in a couple billion years, slam into the Andromeda Galaxy. It'll be fun, actually. We'll make one big new galaxy. We can ignore those. Those are sort of local effects. The general overwhelming effect is that galaxies recede faster from us the more distant they are. And this is the Hubble law. And in fact, it's quite simple for the nearby universe. It's the velocity is just related to distance by a single constant, what we now, of course, call the Hubble constant. And this, of course, is another sea change in our understanding of the universe. Because what it suggests, what it supports, is that instead of living in just a universe where the galaxies are sort of hanging out and not doing much, we actually live in an expanding universe. So this is a little complicated, but follow me. This grid represents space. And each little grid, each little square, is a bit of space. These little dots are the galaxies that reside in space. Now, galaxies are free to move through space. They do that too. Like I said, we're going to hit Andromeda. That's because we're moving, both of us are moving through space at one another. But the other thing that happens is that the galaxies move away from one another because space itself is expanding between them. So here's space at some, you know, beginning time, and here's space at a later time when the space itself has expanded. You can see that the galaxies haven't moved relative to the grid of space, but they've moved from one another because the space itself has gotten much larger. And no matter where you are, no matter which galaxy that you're in, if you look at all the other galaxies, they all appear to be moving away from you with a velocity that is proportional to their distance. So things that are moving away faster are more distant from us. You can also think of the example of a balloon that's being blown up. Just imagine the surface of the balloon, and there are little dots, little galaxies, all over the surface of the balloon. As you blow it up, the surface itself increases. And so all the little dots move away from all the other little dots on the surface. And that's the universe that we're living in. I can actually, so I have sort of a little video of this. Play that. So again, the galaxies are staying fixed on the grid that represents space, and the space itself is increasing, and so the galaxies move away from one another. And no matter which galaxy that you're in, you kind of feel like you're the center of the universe, don't you? Because everything's moving away from you. You're not, alas, the center of the universe. We are not the center of the universe. So not only are we not the center of, you know, the solar system, well, now we're just totally, we're in this giant universe. We're not the center of it. We're just in another galaxy, not really that much different than any other galaxy. And who knows? I mean, there could be civilizations out in these other galaxies having similar thoughts as their time goes on. So, you know, Hubble, he determined that the spiral nebulae are these individual galaxies in their own right, all similar to the Milky Way, although some are quite exotic. Some are forming very many stars. Others are hitting one another, colliding, spiraling in to form new galaxies. And, of course, he found this this wonderful evidence of an expanding universe. Although it should be noticed that Einstein had sort of mathematically seen that the universe should be expanding, but had dismissed it. It was simply, it was too weird. It was too much to, I mean, it's still weird. But, of course, Einstein afterwards said it was sort of one of his greatest blunders to not realize that we do live in this dynamic universe. So very much like Galileo before him, Hubble, by doing very careful observations and having a little luck, it has to be said, was able to really radically reshape our view of the universe. Now, of course, other astronomers have come along since Hubble and have sort of changed our feelings about the universe. Nowadays, we know that, you know, you and I and our planets and our galaxy, everything that we see, for the most part, that's about 4% of the universe. We unfortunately don't really understand to a great degree the other 96% of the universe. We're working on it. There's dark matter. There's dark energy that's causing the universe expansion to accelerate. And there's still many things that we're learning about the behavior, the shape, and the history of the universe. And if you're able to attend the Humanities West program that'll be going on Friday and Saturday, you'll actually be hearing more about some of the most recent discoveries in the history of our universe. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bethany. If any of you have questions on the cards, that'd be great. If anybody would like to ask a question directly, I guess, well, we have some questions. Good. Now they get down to detail. What is the velocity of the expanding universe? 100 miles an hour?
Well, it depends on where you look. Again, you have this relationship between what we see in our local universe and what we see in the more distant parts of the universe that we can see. So locally, we actually don't see much effect of the expansion of space. As I mentioned, there are many galaxies that are traveling through space. We say they have peculiar velocity when they're actually moving through space. But so there are galaxies nearby that we can measure as they move towards each other, as they move towards and away from the Milky Way. And the expansion of space only has a very small effect. You have to start looking further and further and further away to start really seeing the expansion. And then it's actually very difficult to put a velocity. We can measure what's called the redshift, and we can equate that to a velocity. But it's hard to put a meaning on that because, for example, space is free to expand at greater than the speed of light. It can do that. It does. Any objects that we see in the universe that are greater than about a redshift of 1.5, this is slightly more than half the universe away from us, they have redshifts that are equivalent to a motion that is faster than the speed of light. But that is, you know, so that's not what we really think of as a velocity in the sense that we think of velocities on an everyday scale. So I can't actually give you any specific number. I apologize.
Related, what is the universe expanding into?
This is, yes, well, the classic. So we think that the universe isn't expanding into anything. It just is expanding. This is very difficult to think about when we think about, for example, the Big Bang, the formation of the universe. I personally can't wipe my mind of anything and then have a universe suddenly exist. But in reality, that may have been what happened, is that there was just nothing. The Big Bang occurs, and all of space and time and matter and energy, all of that's formed.
Related again, does the universe have a center besides the person who wrote this question?
Yes, no, we've kicked humans out of the center of the universe time and time again. It is very sad if you want to be in the center of the universe. Really, there is no center to the universe. The universe, as far as we know, could certainly be infinite. Then center has no meaning. Now, of course, we can only see a part of the universe, even if it is infinite, because light has a finite travel time. So we can only see out to a certain point in the universe. But the universe has no center. Sorry.
I'm going to ask a question, actually, that's not on here.
Sure.
from the interview on Cron with Alex Filipenko on Sunday, where I said, basically, with everything moving away from us, given enough time, the night sky will be dark. You know, that everything will move away so that it'll go beyond the level where the light can reach us from these galaxies. I suppose that's several billion years away at least. But you did mention a few that are coming closer to us, so that there should be something left in the
night
sky.
Yes, yes. Well, right. we will not be alone. And for what we understand of the universe right now and the nature of dark energy, we don't think that the universe is going to end in a big rip. If it ended in a big rip, everything would be ripped apart. That is, everything down to the subatomic particles themselves would eventually be ripped apart. We don't think that's going to happen. We just think the universe is going to continue to increase in size at an accelerating rate, but it never becomes a runaway event. And so the local universe, anything that's sort of nearby, gravitationally attracted to us, will kind of hang out with us. And again, we're going to collide with Andromeda in 3 billion years or so. We'll form a big galaxy out of that. It'll take about 1 billion years of us swirling in together, which will actually be a very interesting sky. But after that, we'll just be at one big elliptical galaxy. And those stars will hang around for a while. So our sky, if the Earth is still around, I mean, the sun is, we're going to have problems with the sun in 5-ish billion years,
right,
expanding and burning the Earth. But, you know, if somehow we're still around in our galaxy on some other planet or something, there'll still be plenty of stars in the night sky.
I think maybe one thing, so people aren't quite so afraid of this collision within the Andromeda galaxy. If the two galaxies collide together, how many stars would actually hit each other?
Yeah, basically none.
Basically none.
which is kind of weird, but it's true. The distance between stars compared to how big stars are, I mean, we think of stars as big things, but in the scale of the universe, they're very tiny. So they just go sailing by each other harmlessly. Now, big clouds of gas and dust are free to collide, and they will collide, and they'll probably form new stars. So some excitement will occur, but it's unlikely, you know, we're not going to be, like, swallowed by a black hole or anything, probably.
All right. How do we know that the galaxies move away from each other? We do know that they are moving away from us, but why from each other? What evidence is there for that part?
Right. So in the idea that we have of this expanding universe, if everybody were to be moving just away from us, that would put us at the center. And there is, you know, no real good center. So we know that if we were to step over onto any other galaxy, we can understand what we would see from that galaxy. And it turns out it would be the exact same thing we see from our own galaxy. So there's no center. So no matter where you are, you're going to see, you know, all the distant galaxies moving away from you.
I don't know if you're up to speed on this, the science of finding the planets. We have one speaker on Saturday, Jeff Marcy, that got that process started about 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are some discoveries of planets due to very, very tiny little wobbles, you know, that are very hard to measure, like you said, over the other things. What's the consensus on finding Earth-like planets, or is there no consensus? This is one of the great debates going on, that there won't be any, that there will be some.
There should be some. We certainly don't think that, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are, you know, the only kind of rocky planets out there. The Kepler mission that was just sent up is actually a mission that is observing, I believe it's 100,000 stars. It's observing them, you know, all the time, just continually taking pictures, and it's going to produce these beautiful light curves. Now, if the star doesn't change in brightness, it just sort of travels along at the same brightness over time. Okay, that's just a typical normal star. But maybe every once in a while, the planet that's orbiting that star gets in the way. It travels between the star and our instrument. And that'll cause a tiny little dip in the brightness that we see from the star. So you have a star, you're measuring the brightness, then dip, and then it goes back up. And then dip, and back up. Dip, and back up. And you can measure the period. And from the period and the amount of dimming, you can actually determine where the planet is in the orbit, what kind of planet is it, is it a little rocky planet, is it a big gas giant. And it's so far, by the techniques we've been using, which are slightly different, radial velocity techniques actually have to watch the star wobble because of the pull of the planet. And a bigger planet has a bigger pull. So far it's been easiest to discover the big planets. So we know about a lot of these hot Jupiters you've probably heard of. This Kepler mission, the hope is, will now let us see those little Earths, little rocky planets near the sun, the suns. So I think we'll start seeing those very soon with this mission.
With the work that's being done right now, and if we were in a different galaxy, like the Andromeda Galaxy, would we be able to tell Jupiter or Earth? Or that's, they're already, I'll be honest, Jupiter, I think, is too far away for its size.
If you were maybe some of the stars in our own galaxy, you could look back at Sol and notice the wobble caused by Jupiter. We can't actually do this with any other stars in other galaxies.
Right.
We're only right now have any technology to be able to do this with stars in our own galaxy. So even this Kepler mission is just looking at stars within our own galaxy. For stars in other galaxies, it's too far away. We have no hope of being able to do this. So if there are aliens in our own galaxy looking back at Earth, there's, you know, they might be able to see us with similar techniques, or at least detect Jupiter, but not in other galaxies.
What causes the rotation of the nebulae?
The rotation, okay.
Spiral nebulae, why are they rotating?
Right. So two things. The observed rotation that was cited by Shapley doesn't actually exist. These objects are so far away that they are, in fact, rotating, but the motion is too slow for us to be able to measure by actually watching it rotate. What we can do is we can take spectra of the stars in the galaxies, and we can notice the rotation, the slight changes in the blue shift and the red shift of the galaxies, and that lets us know that the galaxies are actually spiraling. And it's the same forces that cause the Earth to orbit the sun. It's all this gravitational attraction, basic Kepler's laws. All of the stars and gas in the galaxies are orbiting. They're in nice stable orbits around usually a massive black hole at the center of the galaxy. And this is just like the solar system. We are, in fact, orbiting the massive black hole at the center of our own galaxy, and it takes us quite a few years to do a full circuit just because the distances are so fast. But we're moving pretty well along there. So,
wait. Are there more universes in the same space where ours is expanding into, beyond where we can observe? That's a very good question.
Beyond where we observe is such a problem.
How do we know?
I can't answer. if I can't observe it, I can't really answer. Now you can you can sort of make up stories or ideas, some of which you might be able to extrapolate some math into, and certainly many people are interested in multiverses and, did our universe form after the collapse and rebound of a universe? Are there other universes abutting our own universe? These are good questions to which there are no answers.
It's always good in
but
science
it's fun to
have,
think about.
Have good questions.
Yes.
A very specific question. NOAA predicts the Carrington event shall recur in 2012. Ever heard of that? Sun energy from increasing storms on the sun's surface may again hit the Earth. Any opinions or thoughts on this? Do you know anything about this?
I don't know all the details of this. I do know there's an issue with the Mayan calendar ending in 2012. And some have suggested that this may be linked to rogue planets in our own solar system that would cause problems with the sun. I wouldn't make any plans to, have a party that day because you think it's going to end. We'll be fine. We can do a lot of measurements and studies. And we know what's in our solar system, and we know there's no rogue planet running around that's going to harm the sun. So we will all be okay. I grant you, in 5 billion years, we will need to start worrying about the sun. but I will leave that to a future generation to ponder.
One of our Humanities West attendees has suggested that we have a program on the Mayan civilization in the fall of 2012, just in case it's the last time we have a chance to do anything. Could you tell us a little bit more about Hubble as a man? I mean, he's obviously shown with a pipe all the time. I think that's one of his British affectations, which the Americans didn't like. Any other stories that could entertain people? Because a lot of people think of scientists until they meet Richard Feynman as or have met Richard Feynman as being a little bit too staid. But
I wish I could think of some. I don't know any more stories. He was always called the Major.
Because he was a major in World War
One. I don't know how other astronomers felt about that, but I know he was often referred to as the Major. When he came back from World War One to Mount Wilson, he apparently addressed himself as such. so I'm not sure if maybe some of that was mocking him or not.
I'm sure at least part of it was. Maybe he was in the same group as Colonel Sanders was.
Can I just ask you to make some comments on the relative speed of some of the things out there so we can get a feeling about how fast things are moving, like the gas and the M1 is moving 600 miles a second? Some of these feelings?
I don't know all the numbers off the top of my head because they usually get something. I mean, they're in general a speed that I cannot really conceptualize. The Earth, the solar system is moving around our galaxy at something like 220 kilometers per second.
So it takes
pretty
fast. Do we have a big idea about how long it takes to go all the way around the galaxy?
It's in the hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions of years, right?
Yes, yeah. I don't know the exact figure, but
we're not going to crack the whip here.
No,
although we are out at the edge.
And certainly, for example, in the center of our galaxy, around the massive black hole, some of those stars are orbiting so quickly that we can watch them on a year-by-year basis, and this is one of the evidence of a massive black hole in the center of our galaxy, is that we're literally watching the stars orbit. And you can measure the full orbit, and given the speed and everything involved, you use Kepler's laws. You figure out there has to be quite a lot of mass shoved into an orbit that is pretty much smaller than our own solar system. And the only option you have for that much mass in that small an area, massive black hole.
I think a lot of people are fascinated. Oh, Roger. Yeah.
Major Hubble also served in World War II. What did astronomy have to do with World War II? Did he contribute anything to the Second World War?
He did. He was actually... trying to remember, it was like an armory or a proving ground that he was stationed at. I don't believe he went overseas, but he certainly contributed on the home front to that effort.
But not with galaxies, presumably.
Well, galaxies wouldn't help that much. certainly, where astronomy came in as far as World War II goes is we were just then beginning to understand fusion and fission, and understanding that, you know, the fusion process is actually what powers the sun. And, of course, those processes became very important with the development of the hydrogen bomb and understanding, you know, basic particle physics, which then, you know, we usurped pretty much to explain the universe.
Well, we have time for one more question.
That's a good question. the universe in the Big Bang was given almost a push, an impetus that we're still traveling on. So that's part of the expansion. And then there's this acceleration due to dark energy. But exactly how that happens is still one of the great questions. Whoever figures that out, Nobel Prize instantaneously, pretty much, because we don't understand, how it is that there's this dark energy and somehow it's causing this acceleration. But I wish I could give you more specifics. I can't. I can tell you it's happening, but not really why or how it's happening.
Right, well, just enough for one last thing to take away the popular notion about black holes. The popular notion about black holes is they look a little bit like your water going down the drain. So it's all spiraling and it's making everything else spiral and everything's going down the drain essentially in the universe. But it's not like that. I think maybe if you can visualize it a little bit for people, that would be helpful.
Right. So
take away the Walt Disney fears.
There is not, we don't have to be concerned about being sucked into, for example, the massive black hole at the center of our galaxy. We're in a perfectly stable orbit around this. Now, for example, the example I like to use is that if the sun were to just become a black hole, we wouldn't really care. I mean, yes, we would miss the sunlight 8 minutes later. But gravitationally, the Earth doesn't care. All that the Earth knows gravitationally is that there's one solar mass worth of material sitting at one of the foci of the ellipse that makes up our orbit. And it doesn't care if that's one solar mass of star or one solar mass of black hole. We'll just continue on our merry way. The problem with black holes is that you can get a lot closer to problem than just a star. Now, if you drive towards a star, at some point you're going to reach, the more or less surface of the star. It's going to be hot. You will be gravitationally attracted to that mass. But the distance between sort of the center of that mass and where you are is large just because there's a lot of physical stuff in the way. Now, with a black hole, you don't have all that physical stuff. So you can start to get very, very, very close to a whole lot of mass that's crunched up together. And once you hit the event horizon, then that's problematic because you have to be traveling the speed of light or faster to escape once you get down there. But as long as you don't get too close to the event horizon, you're fine. I wouldn't suggest necessarily getting close to the event horizon. As you get pulled in, there are gravitational tidal forces that You know, if you're falling feet first, your feet are pulled faster than your head, and you are ripped apart. Well, yes. But so that will actually happen if you get too close. But you have to get too close, which you're not likely to.
So theoretically, you could, as long as you weren't this certain distance away from a black hole, you could just kind of float near it and observe it, and all the weird things and all the these weird things that happen with physics once you're a certain distance to it.
As you start getting close to the black hole, you
like
have
all these weird things happen.
Right. The weird things are the relativistic effects. So you get time dilation and gravitational redshifts. But you have to get really close to the black hole to start having those effects be noticeable. And if you're in your spacecraft, presumably you have the technology to say, hey, you know, there's a whole bunch of mass over there. Mass is pretty easy to measure because of the gravitational attraction it has. If you get close to a black hole, you see a lot of relativistic effects. And in fact, this is one of the ways that we study relativity, is to ask questions about material that is near a black hole in space, because stuff does fall too close to a black hole in space every once in a while, and so we can measure effects from that. But you're not likely to get into trouble.
Not in your lifetime. All right. I think we're over our time now a little bit.
One more question? Go ahead.
For that, plenty of there's plenty of information on that subject at the 2-day program. Sorry to put it off.
That would be another hour lecture,
but that's another
at
hour
least.
Lecture.
So,
it's a very interesting subject, though. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Bethany.
Yeah.